Hello.
Well, hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Hey, Dave. This is Chris Teasdale.
Welcome. How are you?
Very good, thank you. And you?
Super. And who else is here?
Kat, hi.
Kat, welcome. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And you?
Super. Lynn will be joining us in just a bit. I'll send the bios around as soon as I have all of them. I need one more. Welcome. I'm really excited about collaborating with each of you in this series. I've moved some of my introductory comments to the outline so that we'll have more time for the seminar itself. You'll notice where you were directed when you signed up, and I hope you've printed the seminar schedule, the outline, and the syllabus. And it's a pretty annotated or detailed outline, so you won't have to take that many notes. But what we'll do, I'm going to do some introductions at the beginning, and then an overview of the training course and the curriculum, and today discuss the power of story. Now, even though we'll be focusing on money story, this is really about a life, a business, other stories. You'll see in the curriculum the various applications, and we're going to spend some seminars in the beginning really looking at the roadmap system about how to understand and deconstruct a story and help someone create a new one, kind of the mind and brain basis of behavior changes that last. So now, in each of the 12 seminars, there'll be 75 minutes each, I want to preserve some time at the beginning and the end for discussion. Especially, I want to encourage you to bring your cases or vignettes, anything that are challenges to you in terms of working with clients, so that we can discuss them and really apply this system and look at bringing it alive. And we won't be doing coach the coach, but instead of coach the coach, I'd like to have each of you sometime before the end of the training, and I want to reserve a time in the last half of the seminar series for each of you to do a brief presentation, to do a 750 to 1,000 word write-up of a coaching case using the roadmap format. Now, this case write-up can be on yourself, on a client. It will be confidential. And we'll spend maybe 15 or 20 minutes in a later seminar for each of you to present and to discuss this. If you'd like to volunteer time to commit to a particular seminar, that'd be great. If not, later on I'll do an assignment. And I'd like to do this before the last class so that we can complete it by seminar 11. And there is a sample of a write-up of actually someone who did this course before, this training, and gave me permission to use it. It's in the addendum. It's like the third or fourth in the addendum. And it's just a couple of page. It's a self-reflection, some work that he did in terms of his own money story. This was a very well-known professional and wanted to remain anonymous, but gave me permission to use it. So it's a good sample of one to do that, just to get an idea to see if it works for you and if it says something to you. Now, first, before we do introductions, any clarifications about any of the material or any of the housekeeping things that any of you have? None? No confusion?
No,
okay.
You.
All right.
Dave, I was trying to read through. I mean, it looks like we've got introductions. We've got the main, the main manual. And then we've got introductions in a separate, email or such that we printed. Was there anything else?
When you say introductions, you're referring to what now?
Well, the New Money Story Mentor Training, there's I think I printed this off of an email that you sent around. It said it's an introduction to the curriculum, and then it's got Seminar 1, Module 1, Your Money Story, et cetera. I think it's just the outline of the program.
Okay, there should be a seminar schedule, an outline, and a syllabus that's downloadable where you register. The same page is going to have the posting of the seminars. These are recorded. Only you will have access to them, and they'll be posted by probably noon the following day. My IT guy posts them so that you can review anything you may want to look at again. They're downloadable by MP3 as well as being online playback. So at that page is where the downloads are, and that's where the seminars will be posted.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions or clarifications about anything? Let's do a brief introduction. Chris, would you introduce yourself and tell us a little
Sure.
bit about your journey here, about your experiences and plans in terms of coaching?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. My name is Chris Teasdale. I live in Dallas, Texas. Presently, I'm an industrial real estate specialist. In simple, what we tell clients is that we match supply chain strategies with optimum real estate solutions. Been at it about 35 years. My wife is a professional coach. She's been trained under Dave. And so I've been exposed to coaching through her. And at where I am in my career, this is a path that I would like to take my career to next, in working with either young professionals in my business and expand beyond that client base to use the experience and knowledge I've had to help them and mentor and coach them. That's basically about it, Dave.
Okay, so that's what you plan to do with this material is to use that in your own coaching practice and expand beyond, begin with, but expand beyond real estate professionals.
That's correct. I mean, the goal is to phase down my practice and ramp up my coaching.
Okay. All right. Super. Okay. Well, thanks. Great. Kat.
Hi.
Hey.
Oh. Well, first, I guess I want to say thank you for the invitation. I'm really excited to be here. I've, over the years, been in finance and seeing people's or lived their money stories. I've lived my own money story. I've had no money, and then I've had money, and there's that love-hate relationship with money, and I decided to get into life coaching in 2007 and went through Coach Training Alliance, and then I also studied through Erickson College, became certified through Erickson. I really enjoy working with people. I'm also a night owl, and until I received your email, I wasn't clear on the connection between the night owls and my coaching and how that all fit together, and all of a sudden it just resonated. People that don't sleep at night usually don't sleep because they have something on their mind, and it's money, and so I'm really looking forward to this with the experience that I have. My own personal experience, I think this is a great place to go. I've done the one-on-one coaching. What I plan to do is do more group coaching. I've become a facilitator for the Big Mind, Big Heart process. And that entails just coaching groups of people. And I hope to incorporate this learning into just the regular coaching business, but then do groups rather than just one-on-one.
Tell us what Big Mind, Big Heart is.
Big Mind, Big Heart is it's a way to tap into our inner voices and make peace with them and balance it out in our lives. I don't think that it's psychotherapy, but it goes extremely deep, and it's one of the most profound ways of tapping into who we are and moving forward in life that I've ever experienced. It's extremely quick, and it's very effective. You can get someone balanced in a really short, 15, 20-minute period of time, where coaching takes, in my opinion, has taken time, week after week, working with people, you can actually get right to the heart of the matter with the Big Mind process.
Okay, thanks. Great.
Just a different level. If you've heard of Genpo Roshi, it's Zen-based. But it's maybe we can. I can give you some information if you're interested in it.
And what would you like to do with this training? How do you want to develop your practice?
What I would like to do is add the financial picture and the financial story to the coaching and do it in groups of people rather than just one-on-one. One-on-one is fine, but I prefer to do it as I'm moving with the facilitator training, getting into groups. I'd like to do the financial piece of it as well.
Okay. Do you do live or telephone?
You know, my initial idea was live.
Uh-huh.
But I do most everything by phone, so that was interesting. Both.
All right. Okay, super. Anything else? I've interrupted you a number of times. Anything else you wanted to add?
All I want to add is we're going to be together for quite some time. And for me, being a night owl, I actually set the alarm to come to the class. So I'm having my morning coffee. Usually have a little more energy at this hour of the day than other people. And it's just because I just woke up. So if I have
to... You get up crack of noon whether you need to or not, right?
2:30. I should set the alarm for 2:30 today.
Okay. Okay. Is that something you're well-grooved and enjoy, or is that something you want to change?
Pardon me?
Is the night owl something you're well-grooved in and enjoy, or something you want to change?
Well-grooved, and it's night owl coaching, and just adding this piece of the puzzle to it that made sense to me all of a sudden, which was the financial piece. I'm never changing that.
Okay. All right, excellent. All right, thank you. And
thank
you. Coach anybody overseas?
I have someone in Germany.
You could specialize in China.
In Germany, right, because at midnight, we work together, and she's having her morning coffee.
Perfect.
So midnight for me, it's, you know, her morning coffee time. It's perfect.
Now, wait, in farming season, you and your husband do a farm. How do you do the farming since you don't operate by moonlight when you farm? At least I grew up on a farm.
Okay. My husband, he goes and farms, and my support comes when he comes home at the end of the day.
Ah, okay.
So in the evening, I take care of everything that needs to be taken care of, you know, the bookkeeping, things like that. I get to take care of that and support him, of course, with, you know, dinner and the things that a wife would do.
Okay.
So I'm the support on that end of it. And, of course, I have a lot of energy at that time of day so he can relax. So we can almost run 24 hours a day.
Okay, well, I'm clear. That sounds good to me. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Lynn. Has Lynn arrived? We will get her to introduce herself perhaps next time or at the end. So I have a couple of bonuses to announce. I want to let you know that I'm going to have my fulfillment house mail you a hard copy of the New Money Store Client Workbook. You'll see in the curriculum that you have the portions that are in gray. In addition to the introductory and the glossary and the addendum, will be peeled off and be in a client workbook in case you want to use the workbook for groups and things like that and or with clients and co-brand it. You can put your name on the cover and a different first page with your information and that sort of thing. I'm going to send you a copy of Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual after a revision that I'm making. Also, I'll have quarterly mentor groups. Usually do that for graduates, but I want to include you in that group if you are able to do that. Those meet at 1 p.m. Eastern on the first Monday of each quarter, like November, the first week of November is the next. And there's also a white paper that I send around with each of those, so you'll be getting that. The first year license fee is included in the registration. After that, to continue on the registry, the license, the co-branding, all of that, the mentor groups, is like $45 a quarter. So now, as a prologue to our first session, I want to talk about the power of story and the concept of writing a new story, especially focusing on new money story. The remaining seminars, we're going to look at how to do that, at the principles and practice of change, beginning with the foundation of the seven-step roadmap process to create a new story. And we're going to talk about your stories, your money story, and I'll encourage you to do the exercises and work pages that you'll see in the gray, the client workbook, in the curriculum. I want to encourage you to actively understand and work on your own story to apply the process. When you've done it yourself, you're going to be in the best position to mentor it. When you've made your own journey, you can best guide your client's journey. Now, I want to keep the line open for discussion. I'll present for about 40 or 45 minutes in the middle, but I want to keep that open so that if there's a question or clarification that you have, to not hesitate to interrupt me. I'll ask you to manage the background noise, though. You may need to do a mute star six if you don't have a headset, but just manage the background noise so there's not a distraction. But I'll keep the line open because the agreement that I have with my clients, same agreement I'd like with you, is that the rule of engagement is that I want to be able to interrupt a client at any point to look at something and together to examine what was just talked about instead of having to wait for three or four or five paragraphs later. And I want the client to be able to do the same with me. And that's the same agreement I'd like us to have and you to feel free to interrupt me if there's something that you want to talk about. So first, I would request that you write this question down. What is my money story? I'd suggest that you schedule a brief brainstorming session with yourself. Think about your story. Summarize your plot in one sentence. Bullet your major storylines, not your income, expenses, assets, debt, net worth, your money story. And then we'll come back to that and look at the money story that each of you has. And that's what I want to talk about now is to really look at and expand on the idea of the money story. But first I want to pause. Are there any questions or anything about anything we've talked about thus far that you'd like to discuss or clarify? Any housekeeping things at all?
I'm good.
Okay. All right, super. Well, I'm excited about our group, and as you know, I keep the groups really small. I do the training by personal invitation, so I know the people, I know the qualifications, and it means there's a small group, but I love that because we have more of a chance to have exchanges and really develop the group wisdom. Everything that we do and talk about is confidential so that we can talk about experiences and clients. If you want to present clients, and you can keep that anonymous but still discuss the essence of a situation so that we can benefit from that.
Hey, excuse me, just a quick question back
sure.
to Husky. Star 6 puts you, mutes the everything. What do you do to unmute it?
Star 6 again.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Now, I would recommend for each of you who work by telephone with clients to have a landline and a headset because you can do an immediate little toggle switch to turn off or to mute, and there's no beep with 2 or 3 seconds that you lose, and you get way better reception. And of course, with a headset, and of course with a landline, there's not the interference of the noise. So even if you plan just to have an initial discussion with a client, I'd still recommend a landline and probably a headset because you can have a dedicated line that way. So for your coaching business, you can have a voicemail that's specific to your coaching business. So that's kind of the basic investment that I think would be useful for each of you.
Did you say you use the Plantronics?
Yes. Uh huh.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, I see the sticker at the bottom. I got mine through headsets.com, and the number there is 800-450-7686, and you can call them. Once you've selected, you can see the models and the description online. You can call somebody there and ask what telephone goes with those headsets, and they'll give you a couple or three that are compatible, because you have to really have a match of the telephone system and the headset to be sure that they're compatible. And they'll happily give you some advice there. Okay? Okay, let's talk about your money story. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but sometimes not as visible to you. It's a story you talk about every day, think about several times a day, is remarkably simple yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. Warren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. And that can be the case with our own personal stories. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You might get 10 years out of a car, maybe 40 years with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. When I spoke with a well-known self-help guru, an internationally known publisher, actually, about this story, he said, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. At times, you've used this story to do various things, from regulate your moods, maybe to adjust self-esteem, perhaps to influence others. And I think this is really important. How you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients. What they see in your behavior and hear as your beliefs will be what they'll download as their own while you're talking about other things. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you, you speak with it. And of course, it's your money story. Now, let's look at what really is a money story. And as I mentioned, it's not income, expenses, assets, debt, net worth. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale that you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what it means to you, what you feel money says about you. It's a running dialogue of how much you feel you deserve, how much you feel you're worth, how much you think you're capable of. Now, we speak with money in various ways. And think about this with me, about how we use money to speak. We speak in a straightforward way because money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. The wonder of money is it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, yet maybe at times what we fear or lack, or what we covet or crave or spurn or chase or follow. We use money to show how much we care or how little. We use it to measure success or try to buy happiness. We use it to bolster self-esteem. In other words, we use money to communicate. And next, we use money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it an emotional value, build a relationship with it, and really by doing that, make it bigger than it is. We use money to try to soothe emotional pains at times and adjust how others respond to us. We speak with money as a self-statement, and money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. There's a piece in the glossary. The glossary is some of the most commonly used terms. It's a place that I can explain and explicate that a little bit more, and it's also a place that I can have as a good excuse to put some of my favorite quotes. So there's a and it's in alphabetical order. So there's an entry there on self-statement that you might want to look at some point that might explain it a little bit more. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements, and the story always tells most about the teller. Some examples of how we use money as a self-statement: a proclamation of freedom, a currency of caring, a promissory note for happiness, an embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, an instrument of control. An example is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a bright red BMW 540 and drive it in the middle of a busy suburban area that exudes class. Now, contemptuous consumption is when you buy a bright red BMW 540 and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, that's not a self-statement. I'd never buy a bright red car. So without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. We also use money, if you think about it, in self-talk, the messages we tell ourselves. These internal beliefs can become a shadow story. And think about the possibilities here. People who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money might really buy happiness. So we have external and internal dialogues about our money. And let's consider that, because I want to highlight this to have you become aware of the dialogues, some of which are unspoken. Let's look at the external dialogue. That's the easier one. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret, though, is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of what's spoken and unspoken. For example, we can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not an age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what kind of debt do you have? And you may not see dessert. Not too long ago, I was at a writer's conference, and there was a conference there by an internationally known writer's agent. And she was discussing what it was like to work with agents and the various aspects of that. She was discussing working with her authors over the years. She was well into her talk, and two-thirds, three-fourths of the way, about talking about details of the contract negotiations and various aspects. And finally, somebody in the audience said, would you talk about how much money's involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? And she had carefully avoided money. She looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. And an older guy on the back row, not me, said, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling the book. Well, of course, he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion that was really useful to her audience, many of whom were interested in writing books for a living. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. That was exactly one century ago. The year 1913, the therapist Sigmund Freud. Now, a century later, most of us have learned to talk more easily about sex, yet remain seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own personal money stories. In fact, the first book I did about money had this quote on the front flap. The book was called The Last Taboo, Money, a Symbol and Reality. This was in 1986, and I participated in a panel of a therapist and analyst about money and fees. And at the time, they were asking for references. And I looked around, and I was amazed. There were a handful of papers, about a half dozen at this point, and only one book about money in the therapeutic and analytic situation. That was like 20 years earlier, or about money, the psychological aspects of money. And that was about 20 years earlier by a psychoanalyst. And here's something we deal with every day, and people have to be comfortable with it, yet nobody was writing about it. So that was amazing to me, and I saw that as one of the taboos, and promptly set about doing the book. Guess who had this seasoned wisdom? When we don't speak something, we make it more powerful. That was Harry Potter. So let's look now at the internal dialogue. We just considered the external. Let's look at the internal dialogue. While we may not speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, which is really to say our time and energy, for something else. And every exchange involves two prices, financial and emotional. And the conversation that's often silent and automatic has many dialects. Let me give you some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton for my dad on hot summer days. After doing that most of the summer, school started, and at the first break after lunch, my buddies went to the concession stand, and they bought a Coke and candy, and I joined them. And then about two bites into the candy, I stopped. Is this candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? Is this Coke worth one row of chopping cotton? And very quickly, I answered no to both questions. And then that was when family farms were still below the radar of child labor laws. But, you know, when you think about that, we often teach our children about the value of money and perhaps do a clothes allowance in order to be able to be a collaborator rather than authority and talk about whether two alligators are worth one horse and pony. What we often don't think about doing is looking at the cost of money as well as the value of money, because the cost of money is something that needs to be considered as well. And we're going to come back to that. Another internal conversation. At an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, "I'll give you what I never had as a child." Or the preamble of spending may be to rationalize, and some of this is way less unconscious than we would wish it to be. This seems like a lot of money to spend on a big screen HD TV, but if I spread it out over the next 11 years, it only costs 17 cents a day. And my wife said, "Dave, if you want the TV..." So this is a rationalized spending to think about amortizing it. Now, a sidebar here. Set alongside your outline the summary from Module 4 at the end of that on the ABCs of money mistakes and financial fallacies, because I'm going to illustrate each of these. I think there are 27 there. I'm going to illustrate each of these over the next 12 seminars. Now, a couple of more examples of the internal conversation. We regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. George Costanza said, "This is found money. I've got to blow it on a horse." Gifted money spent without debate. Salary money or professional fees, serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement, only with definite need or real emergency. And it's the same dollar. The dollar doesn't know who owns it any more than war bonds knew about the war. This is a framing bias. money is treated differently based on its context. And here's a quote from a documentary from a veteran of three bankruptcies on the verge of her fourth. The high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy. And a final one, the parent. I spend so much time at work. When I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it. Kind of a justification bias. Now, let's think about the ways that money speaks to us. Here's an example. A study in which volunteers had their brain scanned using fMRI scans, a functional video of the brain, when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, as a sidebar here, I have some pretty elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, collaborate with some behavioral economists and neuroeconomics labs, but I can never find studies like this to volunteer for. I'm trying, though. The volunteers were told now, before the tasting, the price of each of the wines. And then they rated the wines, as you might expect, according to price. They liked the most expensive one the best, and then on down, sequentially, the least expensive one they liked the least. And their brains corresponded. The area of their brains that encodes the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, the pleasure center, was more active with the most expensive wine and sequentially on down, exactly paralleling their ratings. Now, the volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. And there was a study from MIT that just came out that found that people get significantly better with a more expensive placebo than a cheaper placebo. Money sometimes communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us in any number of ways: confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, drug. And money serves as a tangible container for various things: hope, freedom, ambition, love, disappointment. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. Now, our core beliefs require a portal for expression. Our various behaviors are a path to the intangible. So think about money equations. Money can make any statement. If I ask you, write down the first word that comes to your mind about what money means to you. Write that word down. Write what money means to you. And you'll see how money can make any statement. Worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power, just to name a few. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. In fact, unmet needs can show up as symbolic wants. And this is what marketers know. A desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and desires can be created by filling them. One of the major enigmas of marketing. And money is a legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look right at it, there's only a design on paper. But when we're offered the chance to imbue that design with meaning, the interpretations are going to be as wishful and varied as the fantasies of the respondents. A true Rorschach. Or of their morals. One woman said, "I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems." Well, now, we know that money isn't related to morals. They're two totally independent variables. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps you money. Or their ethics. Even President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Now, we know that's not true because you can overspend, have a shopping compulsion, gamble, have 5 children, 3 of whom are in college age, live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, any one of a number of possibilities. Now, I'd like you to think about the answer to this, and I'll tell you why I asked the question in a moment. Who in America do you think has the best work ethic? If you cast the broadest net possible to all cultures, races, occupations, who in America has the best work ethic? What's your guess? Anyone? Remember to go off mute. Any guesses?
I'll go with people from another country.
Okay, immigrants. That's a really good guess. And I've had guesses here in Houston with audiences of, you know, shrimp fishermen, Vietnam fishermen, you know, farmers, a number of. Any other guesses?
It's funny you said that, Kat, because I was thinking the same thing. I wasn't even thinking Americans. I was thinking somebody foreign.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Are you ready for the answer?
Mm-hmm.
Heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. They cannot let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem suffers. One heroin addict summarized it by saying, if I don't get up early at the crack of dawn every morning and work all day long, the next day my self-esteem won't suffer. The next day I'll die. Now, I mention that to distinguish work ethic from performance ethic, and especially with success ethic. And think about how when you hear people who have the metric of work ethic, well, I was at my desk 11 hours today, or I've worked regularly for 11 days in a row. Don't confuse work ethic with performance ethic, and especially with success ethic. So the question is, how's that working, and how can you work more efficiently, more efficiently, more happily, and more productively? So why do we make these money errors? Because the more we give money meaning, the more we lose focus on what money really means. Then we do strange things with money. Some examples. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Two of my clients have been Madoff victims. One, a very internationally known person. Another, a very savvy leader. Very, very smart people, but they got scammed. And I've dealt with other people scammed with other, other non-Madoff people. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise balanced individuals can spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Otherwise dependable people can ignore financial matters until they get serious. Highly principled individuals can step over boundaries or write their own rules. And I'm here in Houston, home of Enron, home of Stanford. Others are taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, the CEO of CyberNet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Well, Burton listened to his mama. And the messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to and understood and perhaps revised. And consider this. Money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands or broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring. Here's a 22-second history of money, since you ask. First, two goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of that, not a symbol, as an actual value, because they're worth what their value is, gold and silver. Then, coins as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins were then replaced by paper bills, then paper checks, then plastic, then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money becomes more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money begins to fade somewhat, and our relationship with it changes. And here's another example of the shadow side. I recently heard Dan Ariely, author of Predictably Irrational, present studies that show two conditions that increase cheating behavior. The more people are removed from actual money, meaning more abstraction, such as dealing with derivatives like options and mortgage-backed securities, and recall the complex instruments that Madoff and Stanford dealt with, even other money managers said they don't know exactly what they were doing. So the more people are removed from actual money, the more they cheat as a possibility, the more it introduces the possibility. And secondly, a social environment where you see cheating around you. And we'll talk later about emotional contagion. So money is a way of thinking we know exactly what we're getting. We think we know what money is by what it can do for us, that it will guarantee our expectations. So let's look now, and this is about mentor coaching in general in terms of looking at change and how we can mentor change with somebody. What's the role of the mind and brain in behaviors and financial decisions? The answer is everything. So two questions, or a question and two answers. Why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will somebody repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result? It's kind of like somebody, when they don't understand English, you speak louder English as if louder is going to help. Even when it leads to lower energy, debt, plateaued careers, or disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure. It's predictable. We know what the outcome is going to be. A comfort zone can be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's the default model. We repeat because we know exactly how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty and trepidation. And the easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. So remember this when you're coaching someone. Everyone, as they begin to engage change, will feel uncomfortable. They'll leave the familiar. And if they fail to change, they don't feel safe changing because changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal model that's also synonymous with identity. Now, we tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. If you have a handheld phone, if you can tuck it between your chin and your shoulder so your hands are free, put your palms together and interlock your fingers very firmly. Now, notice which thumb is on top. Now, keeping your fingers locked together very firmly, change so that your other thumb is on top. How's that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Now, change back so that the original thumb is on top. That's why people don't change. Succeed remarkably, or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now consider upping the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change, because there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the other part of that answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. Let me give you an example of how and why that is. The hypnotherapist Milton Erickson told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a really circuitous path with zigzags, indirect turns, and he noticed that every person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was really well-worn, despite its really circuitous route. No one, not a single person, took an easier, faster, more direct route. And he increasingly did this on other days in a more diabolical way, more circuitous, more serpentine. No one ever started a more direct route. They followed the path of least resistance, what was already there. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. So to think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for a novel stimulus, new information, new context, powerful questions, exactly what we do as mentor coaches. Now, we're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness will be experienced as discomfort, a trepidation, uncertainty, anxiety. So someone can read that as, well, my gut's telling me, my intuition is telling me this isn't right. And they're reading that discomfort as they might read it in a usual way of intuition. Or they might read it in an old model of anxiety equals danger ahead, better head for cover. So both of these models could create a misread of the new experience. So that's one of the reasons that as we work with someone and help them to create a new behavior, we also need to incorporate how they see that, how they see themselves in that process to evolve the model that they operate on along with the behavioral changes. And this is necessary every step of the way for another reason. The most powerful force of the human psyche is to return to our identity. So any change of behavior that we have, unless we also have a correspondence with identity, we're going to revert back to our core identity. So this is why we need to help someone evolve those two in a parallel way as we're working with them. So when they're experiencing the discomfort of leaving the familiar, of creating a new experience, we can help them create a new model to accurately read that discomfort, such as this is a signpost of moving ahead and being in new territory without familiar landmarks. This is the anxiety, the uncertainty, the trepidation is validation of moving ahead to a place that you haven't been before, so feeling unfamiliar, uncomfortable, is exactly what you can expect. Now, it will get better, but it's as you do it again and again. So discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. It's located very close to the emotional center of the brain. So it's not like a consortium of function like mirror neurons. This is an actual place in the brain that fires when we spot an error. And what it does, it says this isn't normal when we try something new. And we're going to talk about this later to see how this is part of a power, how we can make this part of a powerful internal navigation system. So I want to pause for a minute and be sure that this makes sense about how we avoid change and look at the mind's contribution, the brain's contribution, because I think this is fundamental to understand as we're working with clients. And we're going to return to this as we look at some of the roadmap steps to look at specifically understanding about how the brain and the mind work so that we can really know specifically how to help our clients and really create a mastery of this. Does this make sense, and are there any questions about it at this point?
It makes sense, and I have no questions.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm following along with that, too. It makes perfect sense.
Okay. All right, great. We're going to expand on that and talk about more about how to use that at a later point. I'm just introducing the idea of story now and also the mind and brain story. And then we're going to look and spend several of the seminars on specifically how to engage with a client to look at recognizing, owning, assessing, mapping change, looking at the elements of their story. So basically, we struggle to embrace change because many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and brain work. And what we're going to look at together is how neuroscience, quantum physics, and strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operations. At times, both our minds and brains can work against us. When you feel with one part of the brain and think with another, you need a map. So that's what we're going to look at doing. We're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change and guide strategies of change. So how do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? How can we reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create wealth and success? The brain has a mind of its own, and we are of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional magnetic resonance imaging, as I mentioned, a video of the brain in action, as it responds to different situations. These studies have disproven the long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses that they choose based on logic. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways, and this has given rise to the entire discipline of behavioral economics, because the rational, logical way of responding to events that economics purports is not the way people respond. It's not the way people invest. It's not the way they write their money stories. So this has given rise to a whole new discipline of behavioral economics and neuroeconomics. And we're gonna incorporate these and the essential principles into our understanding here. So money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activity. We're going to use these findings to inform certain decisions. So this is what emotional economics is, to inform money decisions. Emotional economics is the study of mind and brain and their contributions in money behaviors and financial decisions. And that's exactly what we're about. Now, here's a glimpse at some examples. The prefrontal cortex says, let's think about the 12-month game plan and retirement savings. And the limbic system says, let's have that second cognac and consider that 27-inch iMac. Each part struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without tearing it. Emotions do not simply and only corrupt decision-making. Emotions narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate, so it can distort in that way. But also, the people who feel no emotions or completely segment their emotions are not good at making decisions. Making people happy is not simply giving them more what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects it to continue. David Geffen said, anyone who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. Another example, when someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and smartness. Now, it very well could be, but consider another. Gamblers can interpret good fortune as skill. My wife and I, this is a confession but an example. My wife and I play heads-up poker. And she finally confessed to me that she was reading my tells, and that's how she so consistently beat me. And she said, would you like me to tell you one of your major tells? And I said, absolutely. I need all the help I can get. And she said, when you happen to, I know this is so true, when you happen to draw a really lucky hand, you have a slightly smug look, like you think you're brilliant. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't work. the components that work don't need fixing. They may even be enhanced. The ones that don't work need to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life stories, and to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. Your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story. Money's a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. It enhances who you really are. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money's going to make them more drunk. If someone's insecure, money will make them paranoid. If someone is caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. So, it's not wealth, position, possessions, or even a chase of happiness that creates problems. It's when you lose yourself in the chase. Our money stories are a large part of our life stories. Stories awaken emotion, and money resonates with our most basic emotions. Think about how we personify the economy or the stock market as if each were a story of its own. We make a story out of events in order to infer relationship and assign causality. Well, the market reacted in a very emotional way today and took back some of its gains. You know, as if the market has a mind of its own and becomes its own story. We live our money stories each day. With each monetary transaction, the themes may be unstated, but they're evident in every transaction. Some of the money issues are really about money, but many, most, are about other matters, private or even secret, hitchhiking on money. We write our money stories, we live them, we can revise them, or we can write new stories. So, we're going to learn how you can strategically rewire your brains and reprogram your minds to create wealth and success. And by doing this yourself, and as we'll talk about it, for us, it will give us the very best possibility of doing it for clients. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money. So you do not have to have a financial background to incorporate this way of coaching, whether you're coaching career, relationships, retirements, if you decide to become a money or financial coach, or just look at the money story in someone's life story. It's not about a depth understanding of money. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and how that affects our behavior, including about money. The beliefs and decisions and seemingly inexplicable behavior involving money aren't about money at all. Money is simply a portal to the immaterial and the intangible. And money becomes such a symbol, such a signifier of so many things. The things that the common symbols that so many people attach so many emotional things to, I saw in practicing therapy and analysis, were money, food, and sex, because these are very tangible, specific entities, and they can contain and be an emblem of so many emotional things that are intangible, many of which are unconscious, many of which are unspoken. So, a money story is a large part of a life story. Some of the money issues are really about money, but many are about other matters, private or even secret, hitchhiking on money. So, we began a journey to understand the choice architecture of your money story and other life stories that you write. You write your money story, live it, can revise it, or write an informed, powerful, new money story. Now, just a mention before I stop, you're going to see in the outline an addition that we did discuss, premises for a new money story. I've included them here because they adumbrate successful discussions as we look at the seven steps to understand and change a money story, the roadmap. So this is something that I didn't want to take time to discuss, but I wanted to include it in the outline so that you would have that and be able to refer to it. So we still have some time. Your thoughts and questions and things that this brings to mind that you'd like to discuss.
Dave, where'd you say that is in the outline?
Yes. Uh-huh. It's in the annotated outline at the end of the session one, Premises for a New Money Story. First, does everything make sense to you?
Hi, Dr. Kruger. It's Lynn. I'm really sorry for being late.
Welcome.
On myself.
Great. I want you to introduce yourself in just a moment, but I want to look at clarifying any questions or things that have come up in this discussion or things that you would like to talk about. Well, while you're thinking about that, Lynn, would you please introduce yourself? Were you able to join us fairly soon? Or I mentioned that this is going to be recorded and posted by noon of the next day if you have any schedule glitches. So welcome, and would you tell us a bit about yourself and what you're thinking about in terms of using this?
Well, I've taken other coaching programs with yourself.
Which is creating an immense pressure to come up with new stories on my website.
It's okay. And this one I wanted to take because I want to change my conversation that I have with money. There's never enough, and I always seem to be stuck with anything money related. And I always feel that in order for me to help someone else, I need to have a better understanding and eliminate my resistance to something if I'm going to coach somebody effectively. I just needed to take this course to do that as well as include it in parts of my coaching. I've been doing coaching now for quite a few years, training with it, but I do have a full-time career. My career is with the railway, but my passion is with coaching, and I will continue pursuing that. And I know, and another money story with my current career at the railway is the DB pension, which I'm kind of attached to, which has me stay there instead of leaving and going on deferred contribution.
National Railway of Canada.
Yeah, so there it's one of the few corporations that still offer a deferred pension contribution.
Yeah.
And so I'm very much attached to it, and I'm afraid to leave it for reasons that we know that deferred contribution is what other companies have. So that's what I hope to get out of this is just my relationship with money, changing it, my conversation, and I got some deep-rooted, information from my upbringing that there wasn't enough and there was never enough. So I want to kind of kill that conversation and put it to bed once and for all so I can actually be comfortable in pursuing other career endeavors.
Okay, terrific. Thank you very much. And I mentioned, I don't know if you heard in the beginning, but instead of coach the coach, I'd like to have each of you do a similar 50-word to 1,000-word write-up.
Yes, I saw that email.
Okay, great.
Yeah.
And I want to highlight something that Lynn said just to elaborate about that. She said, in my money story, there's never enough. So that really says a lot about a money story right there. And this is a survey. I don't know if any of you have seen this in, I think I included this in The Secret Language of Money. After an earlier book on money, I did a number of presentations to executives and professionals and did surveys with the audience and had them write down 1 through 3 on an index card and then turn in the index card anonymously and confidentially. And the first two questions was, write down your current annual income. And then second question, write down what it would take for a current annual income to be in order for you to be carefree and worry-free about money, for you to be totally happy about your money. And the striking thing was that in well over 90% of instances, people thought it was about double. For people who made $100,000, they thought it would take about $200,000. For people who thought who made about a half million, they thought it would take about $1 million. And curiously enough, over time, in follow-up, people who increased their income had a trailing double. In other words, people who made $100,000 thought it would take about $200,000. When they got to $200,000, they then thought it would take about $400,000 for them to be happy and worry-free about money. So that really brings into focus the question of what specifically is good enough. Because, as you know, more is not a goal any more than perfect is a goal, because you never get there. You never get to perfect, you never get to more. So to have a specific defined goal can bring into focus what enough is, and specifically the question of what good enough is. So that's something that may be useful to keep in mind in terms of someone getting to good enough and getting to a point of satisfaction and true enjoyment. So other thoughts or things that you'd like to talk about from what you've heard, just in the overview about money story?
Was that intended to be?
I don't think so, from my stand. Oh, go ahead.
Nope, it's okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, I'm obviously new to the game of coaching, and so a lot of this I'm just taking in and just, you know, really trying to process a lot of this. I mean, I've followed along everything of what we've talked about. Of course, a lot of it is in the materials that I've read as well. I don't really have any questions at this point.
Okay. Okay. And I mentioned this just to think about beginning to listen to people's stories about not just the content, but the process of how they construct it, to really listen to how they put together their stories, how they listen to themselves. And something that that will develop a good bit more is that neuroscientists estimate that about 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. And this means that the behaviors, the beliefs especially, the attachment patterns, behavior patterns, are not in someone's conscious awareness. So this means that we can have a surface story. And the surface story may be, I'd like to generate more income and create wealth, while a shadow story may not be conscious. The shadow story can be a belief that can counter that story. People who are really spiritual don't have money. I don't think I have what it takes. I'm not sure I was born to have more money. Various kinds of beliefs that can take the form of a shadow story that can go in an opposite direction of a surface story. So in another language, this is a conflict, but in a coaching language, I think it can be very useful to think of it as someone constructing two stories simultaneously, so that when they do, if they're aware of the other story that is creating a resistance to moving ahead or a counter to move ahead with their surface story, we can look at that with them and help them resolve that to have all of them going in the same direction and to align themselves with their needs and ideals and have their story being a unified story going all in one direction, so that they can feel that all of them is all in for what they want to do. And often that's important to look at and come to see. And we may see it indirectly in terms of behavior or performance, to see and infer a belief that can really counter a story that someone wants to have. Well, we're out of time. If there are things that come up in the reading as you're working with clients, jot them down, and we'll always save some time at the beginning and the end of every seminar to look at questions, any questions from the reading, things that have come up, especially any case material or vignettes that you'd like to discuss that we can benefit as a group from discussing, from applying some of these principles? And then later we'll get into the roadmap case that you write up of yourself or of a client and have some material there to discuss. So thanks very, very much. I'm excited about our group and what we're going to co-create. And we're off and running. So have a great rest of the week, and we'll pick up right here next time.
All right. Thank you.
Have
See
great.
Ya.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.